thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
The strikes were a spectacular military success.
Iran attacks a U.S. base in Qatar following U.S. military strikes over the weekend. What's next in this conflict? And the Trump administration plans to shut down the suicide hotline for LGBTQ youth next month. We hear reaction from local advocates. And now to some of today's top stories. The extreme heat warning in the area will continue through midnight tonight as the heat index topped 100 degrees today. The National Weather Service says the hot temperatures will continue into tomorrow with highs between 87 and 93 degrees. For the rest of the week, humidity remains and temps will stay in the upper 80s to mid-90s for highs, even as chances for storms roll in. The service reminds folks to stay hydrated, wear light, loose-fitting clothing, and remain in air conditioning as much as possible. For more on where to find one of Chicago's 250 cooling centers, please visit our website. Supporters of phasing out the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers say their approach is working.
Tip workers in Chicago have seen some of the fastest income growth in the country. In over 4 years, 42% increase. And now restaurants are not just surviving, they're thriving. In fact, in the city, there's 856 new food establishment licenses in 2024 alone.
In a new report, the group One Fair Wage says research shows restaurant workers experienced a 49% increase in their income from both ending the sub-minimum wage, but also due to steady tip income. The next phase of the increase begins on July 1st, when the hourly wage for tipped workers increases from $11 to $12.62. But the Employment Policies Institute criticizes this new data, saying it leaves out key economic indicators that would show a loss of jobs in 2024 compared to before the tipped wage law was in place. And the Illinois Restaurant Association is calling on the city of Chicago to pause the next wage increase. Catholics across Chicago are paying their respects tonight to the memory of Sister Rosemary Connolly. For more than 50 years, Sister Rosemary served as administrator of Misericordia Heart of Mercy, starting and designing its programming to provide services for children and adults with disabilities. Misericordia today provides a community for the 600 children and adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities who live on the Northside campus, as well as the 1,200 employees and thousands of volunteers, both on campus and as part of the outreach program. Chicago Tonight visited with Sister Rosemary to mark her 60th anniversary as a nun back in 2009.
I do remember my first day on the job, but from the moment I walked into Misericordia, it seemed like, hey, this is right, and I wasn't afraid. The overall goal would be to create an environment that every single person, every child, every adult, no matter how disabled they are, would feel loved and respected and challenged and know that whatever they can accomplish is what will be and can be and will help them.
Visitation for Sister Rosemary continues until 8 tonight at Misericordia with a funeral mass tomorrow morning at Holy Name Cathedral. Up next, the latest on the aftermath of U.S. military strikes on Iran, right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Iran attacked a U.S. base in Qatar today. No casualties are reported, and President Trump thanked Iranian leaders for giving the U.S. advance notice of the strike. Today's action comes after the United States bombed three nuclear facilities in Iran on Saturday night in what Trump called a spectacular military success. So, what is next? Joining us are Ibrahim Abusharif, Associate Professor in Residence in the Journalism and Strategic Communication Program at Northwestern University, where his areas of focus include digital media and religion, globalization, and contemporary Islam. And Paul Post, Associate Professor at the University of Chicago, where his area of research and teaching is international relations. Gentlemen, thanks to you both for joining us. Ibrahim Abusharif, let's start with you, please. Northwestern University has a campus, a university in Qatar. You have students there. What are you hearing from them?
Well, they've been texting me all day with videos also telling me what they're seeing, what they're hearing, and the fears, of course. But yeah, it's been ongoing. I don't think they anticipated, I don't think a lot of us anticipated that the Iranians will attack the American base in Qatar, because the entanglements, economic entanglements between Iran and Qatar are significant. They have a shared gas field, and they need each other. So I think a lot of people were surprised by this. But, you know, the attack on American base looks a little bit choreographed. You know, it's sort of, you know, we did respond, this is what we did, and the like.
I see Paul Post nodding his head in agreement to that part about the choreography, and I want to come back to you in a second, Paul, because Ibrahim, I wonder, what was your initial reaction to the U.S. striking Iran over the weekend?
Well, I was very disappointed. I was disturbed because I think it destabilizes the region, and they're using nuclear war again, or nuclear, sorry, not hopes not nuclear war, nuclear weaponry as a reason to get engaged militarily with another country. This was... We shouldn't forget what happened in Iraq and the senseless loss of life, hundreds of thousands of civilians, over something that panned out to be untrue. And I don't think this is a failure of intelligence. I think it's a failure of a moral policy, because I think the brain said in the White House knew about this. So here we are again. We've been told for almost 25 years that Iran is 3 months away from a weapon. So I think we need to be a little bit curious about that statement and using nukes as a reason to destabilize a regime. And they mentioned the word regime change. I don't think that's the goal. I think it's regime failure. And they're hoping to turn Iran into a failed state, because power in that region threatens the Israeli, any kind of power.
Right, because there's also been talk of sort of mission creep, right? Is this about preventing Iran from developing a nuclear weapon, or is this about changing the regime in Iran? And obviously, people are going to have different thoughts about how to approach either of those. Paul Post, should people in the U.S. here, should they be concerned about what's happening?
Well, I think the key word to use here is choreographed, or I've even been talking about this being posturing or symbolic. And I would apply that both to the strike today that Iran launched against the U.S. base, but also to the U.S. strike over the weekend. In many ways, it was also highly choreographed. Apparently, Iranian officials also had some prior notice to the attack. They were able to actually move out some of the material from the facilities that were bombed. And it was done in a way to minimize casualties, which is good, but it was mostly done as a way to kind of signal that the U.S. would do something. I do think that President Trump was reluctant to get fully involved in a war, but he also maybe felt a bit of a pull because Benjamin Netanyahu has been asking him to be able to become involved. I think this was a way he could do it, but in a manner that, again, was kind of symbolic and choreographed. And then we've seen Iran kind of respond in the same way. What that means then is that this is probably not as serious of a situation as it could have been. And so in that sense, there's less of a level of concern. There was some concern over the weekend when it wasn't yet clear how much this was choreographed, because the FBI had even issued warnings about possibility of Iran using, say, proxies around the world to perhaps launch attacks to U.S. citizens. That's why there was a travel warning, for example. But that doesn't seem to be the case anymore.
Ibrahim, Trump has said, the president has said, that he wants peace in the region, that he wants to negotiate. If that is the case, why do you think he took this step?
Well, I think the whole thing is puzzling. I don't think that he has full agency in this decision. The United States and Iran were in talks, actually, about to defuse the situation. And it's really important to stress here that I don't think the Iranians are really that interested in having a weapon. They're interested in having the sanctions removed from their country, to have their assets that were frozen, unfrozen, and to join the international commerce community and to prosper. And so I think that they would, I mean, they were pushed to the point of finding some leverage and making some international noise by having this enrichment, uranium enrichment. And so I think that they were pushed to this. They were, since 1979 revolution, they were a pariah in the international community. George Bush called them one of the axes of evil. And all these words that in propaganda theory, if you study propaganda theory, those are carefully chosen words, because you can't reason with evil, you can only defeat it. And so these words created a sort of image of Iran that really has roots in colonial mindsets about, you know, about the global south in general. And so I think the Iranians would prefer to have a diplomatic solution to this. I think having nuclear weapon is not on their top schedule.
Paul Post, there's still debate about exactly how close Iran was to having nuclear capabilities. If that is the case, and it was uncertain, then is this attack premature while that debate is still going on?
I like my colleague's earlier statement about that Iran has been 3 months away for 20 years. And I think there's a lot of truth to that statement. Over the weekend, someone was sharing a video of the number of times that Benjamin Netanyahu over the past decade has said that Iran is on the brink, Iran is on the brink. And he's not the only one who has made those kind of statements. And of course, heading into this past week, or actually heading into Israel's most recent escalation or attacks against Iran, even Macron, the president of France, had raised the alarm about concerning evidence. So it wasn't just the Netanyahu raising the alarm, there were others. But it's still not clear exactly how close Iran is. What is clear is they're closer now than, say, they were back in 2017 when President Trump ended the Iran nuclear deal, which was, of course, brokered by the Obama administration as a way to try to achieve the kind of sanctions relief that Iran is seeking, and in turn create monitoring systems to ensure that any kind of program that's developed would be for peaceful purposes. That was eliminated by the Trump administration in 2017. They opted instead for their maximal pressure campaign. What is notable is that Trump did seem to want to go back to negotiations. They had been in the process of negotiations when Israel launched its strike. We could talk more about why Israel would seek to do that in this instance when it seemed like they were close to reaching a deal. However, it now seems like maybe those talks will be back on.
Ibrahim, Iran already responded with missile attacks on, we know, of course, obviously, about the U.S. military base in Qatar. What do you make of Iran's response?
Well, I think it wasn't an attempt to destroy the base. It was an attempt to make some noise. I do think, even if you look at the choreographed response, that this indicates it's a signal. It's signaling that we're ready to get back to diplomacy. Iranian armaments are actually considerable, but they held back. They have a public they have to satisfy. They have the own local internal narrative they have to produce. And so I think that this was interesting. But I think it tells us that they want to get back to diplomacy.
What does this mean for future negotiations? If you believe this to be a signal that they want to get back to the negotiating table.
Well, I think there's going to be some time in which there's national ego. So when the egos are reset and they can go forth with the negotiations, it may take a little bit. This definitely put in a dent. There was an attempt to have this thing resolved through diplomacy. But that was shot down by the Israeli attacks on Iran. Iran, took severe hits by that. But again, I think the United States did not have the strength to resist Israeli needs to bomb Iran. Obama would have allowed Netanyahu to do this. It's an interesting, easy game to play by saying what somebody else would have done. But I just don't think that this is a show of weakness on the Trump administration. Not strength. You know, I see the bluster and the bravado. Oh, yeah, we did great. But again, you have to look back past those words.
Paul, how has the U.S. standing on the world stage shifted over time?
Well, this is something that has shifted. This is something that a lot of people have been talking about ever since Trump came back into office. You've heard a lot about the decline of the U.S. reputation and so forth. I think right now people aren't fully sure what to think because it's not fully clear what Trump himself thinks and what he wants. I think what's less important or what's more important than the U.S. reputation in the world is just simply predictability. And people want to know that this is what the U.S. is seeking to achieve. And right now, it's not clear. And that is one of the things that even this past week, when you looked at the various tweets that Trump was putting out there, it was like, are they looking for regime change? Are they trying to disable the nuclear program? It's not clear what's going on. Having said all that, it is the case that throughout the region, Iran is viewed as a destabilizing force, and there's a lot of nations in that region that would not be happy if Iran had a nuclear weapon. Now, of course, we can go back to the conversation of how close was Iran? Is Iran actually truly seeking a weapon? But I think that one thing in terms of looking at international standing, even if the rest of the international, even if, like, say, countries in Europe are questioning about the legality of the operations either by Israel or the United States, there's a lot of countries in the Middle East region, the greater Middle East region, that even if they're not saying it publicly, I think are actually okay with taking steps to prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon. They don't want to see a large war, but if these operations are successful in, say, dismantling, they would be okay with that.
Israel, no doubt, among the nations that would not like to see Iran with a nuclear weapon. And we should mention that the president did share on Truth Social a post really just within the last 30, 40 minutes saying that a ceasefire had been agreed to. Of course, there will be more to learn about that in the coming days. We'll have to leave it there for now. Thanks to my guests, Ibrahim Abu-Sharif and Paul Post. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
And we're back with more right after this. The Trump administration is shutting down an LGBTQ suicide prevention hotline. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Department said the 988 Suicide Crisis Lifeline will close the specialized services program for the LGBTQ plus youth on July 17th. The administration has said the proposed budget would not grant taxpayer money to a chat service, quote, encouraging children to embrace radical gender ideologies. They say the services will be folded into the main suicide prevention line. Joining us now with more are Shannon Parker, CEO of Brave Space Alliance, and Precious Brady Davis, Commissioner for the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District of Greater Chicago. Ladies, thank you both for joining us. Commissioner, starting with you, please. Since its launch in 2022, there have been over 1.3 million contacts to this service. Why were these specialized services needed for the LGBTQ plus community?
This is so important because we know LGBTQ youth are four times as more likely to commit suicide than their youth counterparts. Youth deserve people who understand what it's like to come out. It's important for people who don't have resources, in particular in red states, for them to be able to call someone, to have someone to hear them, to give support, and it's absolutely disastrous.
When users call, what's provided for them on that line?
It's support services, it's resources, it's comfort. It's someone telling them that it's okay to be who you are. When people see themselves reflected, they say, I can be that too. And with this hotline being removed, I'm scared about the disastrous results and that LGBTQ young people will not have hope and have someone on the other line when there's not a resource.
Shannon, Trump administration is saying the 988 call line can handle all the calls that they may receive or that the LGBTQ plus service would have received. Do you think the standard line is equipped to handle the volume of calls, but also the nature of the calls?
I think that's presumptuous at best. right? When we think about the scores of young people, particularly in the LGBTQ community, more narrowly the trans community, who attempt suicide yearly, I would like to see the data that supports such an assumption. I think it goes without saying that to be better covered in case of is better than to be not prepared, right? So I would not want to test that theory out, especially when it comes to really vulnerable lives, right?
Right, and when we're talking about youth in particular,
yes.
right, under the age of 25, which trans or not, is a tricky time
yes.
in a young person's life. The statement released from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration notably removed the T in the LGB is what it referred to, LGB plus, removing that T. What does that say to you?
It says to me that trans people, per this group, are a disposable population. It says that this is an administration that wants this population to disappear. And whatever disappearance looks like, I think, is left up to the imagination, right? Again, it says that there is a blatant deprioritization of this really vulnerable community.
Do you think it's a coincidence that this decision was made in the middle of Pride Month?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
And Commissioner, I see you're shaking your head as well.
I think that this administration has shown animus. From the inauguration, we saw President Trump say that there are only two genders, that gender non-conforming youth, that they don't exist. Last week, we saw the Scrimeti ruling from the Supreme Court. What is it like to be a trans young person in this country at this time? They're literally trying to erase trans young people. And I think that we, as leaders in the community, we say we are going to fight back for our young people. Mental health is a part of public health, and young people deserve the same services in particular as everyone else.
According to a national survey conducted by the Trevor Project, Black, transgender, and non-binary young people report disproportionate rates of suicide risk, with 58% yes. seriously considering suicide, 25% attempting suicide. That's in 2022. Mm-hmm. Shannon, why is this rate so disproportionate? What do we know?
Oh, my goodness. I was just talking about this earlier. It's really interesting because suicidality in communities of color is relatively low. We're talking about in the non-LGBTQ community. Mm-hmm. But when we talk about in the LGBTQ community, particularly trans community, oh my goodness, we see suicidality, which is so small in the majority community, skyrocket in the LGBTQ community. So what this says is there is a lack of supports. There is a lack of resources. There's just an overall encouragement for this community, whether spoken or unspoken, to go away.
Commissioner, are you concerned that without a service like this, we could see those numbers increase?
I'm absolutely concerned. There's no way that I get to be the first Black trans woman elected to public office without mentors investing in me, without saying, you go be you, you go be great. That there were great trans people who came before you. You are part of a great legacy. And so I'm disheartened to see that this resource will no longer be available for LGBTQ youth.
And of course, as you mentioned, the Supreme Court upholding Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care for minors last week. Commissioner, what's your reaction to that?
Once again, it's a disgrace. Trans young people deserve access to gender-affirming care just like everyone else. This administration has blood on their hands, and we're not going to stand for it.
Shannon, what recourse do advocates have in absence of this hotline? Is there a lot of lawsuits have been filed against choices that have been made by this administration? What can be done here?
So lawsuits are a tangible way at speaking out, but I think, again, right now it's important that we focus on the individuals who are being most affected by this. So we have to go back to grassroots methods. You know, we have to open up our own hotlines. We have to open our doors. We have to be available for these young people. You know, we're so blessed to live in a time where there is social media, right? There are more outlets and more group supports. And we're just going to have to really remind young people that those resources are available at our local community organizations and beyond.
And to that point, 30 seconds left, what are some other services for LGBTQ plus youth that you want them to know about?
Absolutely. So we have Brace Based Alliance, of course. We have the Center on Halsted. We have other organizations like Life is Work. We have so many places. Task Force, my goodness, they do a lot of great work on the city's west side. But also, too, I would encourage young people to do their research and look at what their local organizations are in their communities as well.
Commissioner, a couple you want to shout out also?
Yes, I also say Gender Cool, Heilbronn Health. I'm proud to be the Chief Strategy Officer at Center Halsted. We have a great youth program for young people ages 13 to 24.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Precious Brady Davis, Shannon Lynn Parker, thank you both for joining us.
Appreciate it. Thank you for
having us. Thank you. And that's our show for this Monday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Sellers of the magazine Streetwise share their stories in a new book. We hear from the local high school student who helped them put words to paper. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports educational initiatives in the legal profession.